Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 2 years ago, shortly after Donald Trump was elected president, Eric DePlace, Programs Director for Sightline Institute, wrote to his friends and colleagues, "I want you to write down your predictions for the future. It's conventional wisdom that the Trump presidency will yield unusual events and disruptions. But what exactly and how? Think broadly about your hopes and or dreams and or fears and or nightmares and or delusions and spell out how it's going to go down. Will Trump be impeached? Over what issue? Will he start a war? With who? Will the markets melt down? What will trigger it?" We've already opened two of Eric's time capsules on this show, and now it's time for him to join us in opening the penultimate one. After comparing the projections made 2 years ago with today's realities, we'll move on to talk about the continuing fight to stop fossil fuel infrastructure from gaining a foothold in the Pacific Northwest. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Barbara. I appreciate it.
And Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, too.
So we actually both realized that we're off schedule. We weren't supposed to open the time capsule this year. We're supposed to wait till next year. So that's why I'm calling this one the penultimate time capsule.
That's right. We've got one more year until the final one.
Right. And it'd be really interesting. So we'll probably spend most of the hour talking about what's going on in fossil fuel infrastructure land here in the Northwest. But let's just start by, it's an interesting time actually to be opening this time capsule. People, I guess, didn't write anything specific for the 2 year mark, did they, in their projections?
They didn't. I had people write a 6 month, 1 year, and then a 3 year. And I kind of wish I'd had a midpoint here, but I don't have one, so we'd just sort of guess.
So we can extrapolate between the 1 year and the 3 year.
That's right.
Yeah. And actually, looking at what's happening, I'm thinking about, because I was one of the participants in this, full disclosure, and I'm thinking about what I was thinking 2 years ago and how close we are. And, I mean, some of the big issues I think that that I thought about, and I think some of the other people you mentioned, was what would happen in the midterm election. So how does that shape up with what at least people were predicting for a year from now?
Well, so people's predictions were, I mean, they were interesting because most people were pretty pessimistic, that I included. I didn't include them because they were pessimistic, but most people came back to me with pretty pessimistic responses. But they were sort of all over the map. I don't think I can make a generalization about what people thought. But I do think that most people kind of went one of two ways. They thought either by the midterms, the Democrats would be retaking power and re-seizing power, although some people predicted sort of a splintering of one or both parties, which still may be in the offing, who knows. Another set of people sort of thought, well, this might be kind of the end of American democracy as we know it, and the Republicans will have effectively eroded the mechanisms of democracy and voting and will be in the process of somehow sort of seizing permanent control of government. I actually think there's a plausible reading of events that's consistent with that, too, especially given all the voting rights scandals we're seeing. That's kind of the two sort of general trends that I observe when I look through what people wrote down.
Well, it actually looks like they all are happening at the same time. But
yeah.
I would say I'm less worried about democracy being totally eroded and having a one-party Republican system in this country, because despite the fact that it really looks like the election, particularly in Georgia, but probably also in Florida, were basically stolen or at least gerrymandered away from very plausible and very likely to win Democratic candidates, that there's a federal judge upheld the gerrymandering law, overturning the gerrymandering of North Carolina. And
right.
There's some optimistic things on the horizon about there being a real awakening about just how corrupt our elections are because of gerrymandering and because of some other things. And then the fact that election in North Carolina was just like outright stolen, the congressional seat is looking like, I mean, that's another very interesting thing. But also in looking at how it wasn't, I think my projection was that the Democrats were going to take back the House and the Senate in 2018. And it's interesting, didn't happen in the Senate, but the House is in perhaps more optimistic hands than maybe we projected. And I wonder how that looks with what some other people projected.
Yeah, I mean, so if it's okay, I'll read some of yours. You actually, unique among all of the respondents, you provided both a negative view of the future and a positive view of the future, which I thought was kind of a clever way to parse it. But yeah, in your positive view of the future, you said Democrats, having taken back the House and the Senate, immediately moved to impeach Trump in January 2019. In the meantime, a growing movement is calling to void the 2016 election and have new elections, creating a constitutional crisis. So that's kind of interesting because, you know, a very progressive Democratic caucus has arrived, some of whom are calling quite clearly for impeachment. So on that score, I think your prediction wasn't too far off. Interestingly, my mom made almost the exact same prediction that you did. Let's see, I'm just going to scan down. A lot of folks, one person I want to identify by name, she said, Trump is convicted of one of the following, if not all three: bribery, dereliction of duty, and abuse of authority, becomes the first president in this era to be impeached and removed from office.
Actually, it'd be the first ever, because I don't think Andrew Johnson was actually, he and Clinton were impeached, but they weren't convicted.
That's right, yeah. Kristen Eberhardt, who is a Sightline staffer actually based in Portland, who works on democracy reform for us, she predicted this is for 3 years out, so, but she said she predicted Trump is impeached by the third year, and Pence becomes president. But then she also predicted that Trump would start a reality TV show about being president.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't like it a lot. But it sounds really plausible.
Yeah, it does. I think that sort of captures the flavor of what I'm seeing here as I scroll through.
Well, the other part of it is like looking at what's happening around the wall and the government shutdown and the economy starting to melt down, or at least, I mean, it almost melted down and then it kind of pulled itself back. And we realize that the stock market has nothing to do with rationality at all, and it's more emotional than probably a psychiatric ward in its mood swings. But I just wonder, if were there any predictions about the economy and things like government shutdowns and government paralysis that we are witnessing right now?
Yes, there was lots about both, actually. So I've got a few folks who respond to this who are in the investment banking world, and I'll read one of them. I'm not going to identify them by name, but one of them wrote to me, a friend of mine, and said, he's by the third year out, said a full-fledged bear market has finally unfolded after a long bull market. This is why he's good at this stuff. Let's see, inflation is roaring with the consumer price index above 5%. Possible food crisis on the horizon. Again, this is a year out for him. So he could still be right about some of that. Let me find another one here. Here we go. Let's see. Another person who works in finance said, again, a long bull market run followed by an eventual collapse of the stock market, taking us way back into negative territory. Now, again, that's a prediction for a year from now, but it looks pretty canny right now. And then lots of folks who have some sort of decent knowledge of economics and finance, but who also think about climate change, predicted that there might be climate-induced disasters that would yield economic shocks around the world, and that those would come home to roost in the U.S. as well. Various versions of natural disasters that began to make clear that climate change is a sort of an existential threat to our economic well-being. Here's another person who said several folks predicted this, that national debt would be at a all-time high, or that deficit spending would be at an all-time high.
You're already there.
Right, exactly. And with the tax cuts, from last year, certainly there's no end in sight to really big deficit spending going forward. So, folks were kind of sort of right about a lot of this stuff, it feels like.
Yeah, anybody predict that Mar-a-Lago was going to be underwater by 2020?
Yes. In fact, one of the investment bankers I read earlier had suggested that Trump will finally admit that man-made climate change is a real thing, which we haven't seen yet. And he goes on to say, but Trump will say that only he can fix it, and he'll start by building a seawall around Mar-a-Lago.
Maybe it'll deflect his attention from the border wall with Mexico.
Yeah, exactly, right.
He'll build one wall at a time. But.
better use of his money. Yeah.
Well, one of the things, I mean, I was thinking about all of our fears 2 years ago as we were heading into this Trump era, and looking now that we're 2 years into it, and in some ways, I think we're a little bit inured. I mean, because we're not as raw. I mean, some of it is good because I think people are organizing and doing really good things. And it was very helpful to see that at least the House returned to Democratic control. It was disappointing to see the Senate not, but not unexpected. But it's interesting to think about the kind of existential fears stirred up in amongst your friends by Trump's election and watching the ways that it's playing out. And now that we're 2 years into it, I wonder how we're... I just wonder how we're grappling with it, and if that is any of that was predicted in the time capsule. If people were seeing ways that we might be dealing with this real shift in reality.
Yeah, you know, not too many people actually responded with that. I mean, there were lots of folks who predicted some version of a fractured Democratic Party or a fractured Republican Party, but I didn't see quite as much about the sort of grassroots uprising and people's response, the resistance movement, all that. Didn't really make itself felt as much on these predictions. I think you had some stuff to that effect. But lots of folks seemed to kind of occupy a world that was sort of a worldview that's maybe a little more cynical than that, thinking that these kind of big systemic shifts would kind of happen with or without opposition pushback to them.
Well, I wonder if you should have your friends update their time capsules and do another one for next year.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think it's interesting to me to think about, in some ways, things are really different than I think any of us would have imagined in a good way. In terms of a bad way, I think they're not quite as bad as a lot of our fears, but they certainly are heading in that direction. And then there's another thing that I don't think any of us... really grappled with was the sense of humor. There's a certain sense of humor that we've developed, which I think is maybe it's a gallows humor, but which you put that, I think, in your email originally, but that in a way that the kind of humor that people have developed maybe is helping us get through this.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I mean, it does. You can see in the the language that people use that there's a certain amount of humor or gallows humor and I think that is something I've kind of observed among my peer group, professionally and personally. But folks are not, you know, I don't think that the left or progressives have sort of laid down and let things happen. It feels like it's been a really we've sort of used humor as one of our tools for standing up and resisting this stuff and taking back power incrementally. Sure, but you know, lots of folks also at the same time had some pretty dire predictions that, you're right, haven't come to pass. Lots of people predicted war, either a major war involving other powers or a major war involving us. And lots of people predicted that Trump would use military engagement by the U.S. to basically coerce some form of takeover of our democracy. Those predictions largely have not borne out, thank goodness.
And instead, he's withdrawing from he's withdrawing from Syria and Afghanistan instead, which is
yeah, yeah, exactly. So that really hasn't. But I would say 2/3 of the people predicted that we would get involved in new military action, and many of them said, you know, it's going to be substantial and really risky. So. We'll see. We've got another year until until we can check back. But I like your idea of extending this time capsule and having people renew their predictions based on what they know now.
Well, I'll be happy to help out with that.
Oh, good.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LP FM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Eric DePlace, who's the Programs Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle. We're going to talk now about the continuing fight to stop fossil fuel infrastructure from gaining a foothold in the Pacific Northwest. And this kind of ties in a way to our conversation today with those predictions that we all felt 2 years ago. Because one of the things that I witnessed shortly after Trump's installation as president was this real surge in grassroots opposition to these fossil fuel projects that have been looming on the horizon in the Northwest for, well, in some cases, I guess about 14 years, 15 years, if you want to go all the way back to Astoria, LNG, and Jordan Cove. So I wanted to talk about start by talking about how these movements have in some ways not just been a response to this pressure on the Northwest to be drastically changed and industrialized by the fossil fuel industry, but also maybe it being connected to an outpouring of resistance to the whole Trump agenda.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a really interesting way to portray it, and I think it's right. I mean, there, you know, so what I like to sort of back up just a little bit, and you know, and remind people that the Northwest has been under almost a sustained assault for a decade or maybe a decade plus. That's ahistorical, but the assault is basically just rush to the Pacific Northwest ports of fossil fuel infrastructure, so oil trains, coal terminals, liquefied natural gas, new gas pipelines, new oil pipelines. I mean, you name it. What's happened over the last decade has been hard to conceive of because there's so much infrastructure that's been proposed with such a huge carbon load that it would potentially carry. And the response to that has been pretty astonishing to watch. I mean, I would not have a decade ago predicted that the opposition movement to that would be so strong and so effective and so widespread. And I think you're right that with the installation of Trump into the presidency, it sort of increased the intensity of the folks who were already in opposition, and in some ways it broadened the opposition movement. And, you know, my belief, and I wish there was a way to test this, but my belief is that fossil fuel infrastructure, when it's proposed for a community, has this really clarifying effect. Like, everybody sort of has these theoretical views about climate change or the energy economy or whatever, but when you try to build a coal terminal in your neighborhood or you see an oil pipeline scheduled for your city or passing not too far away or a liquefied natural gas plant for your town, all of a sudden people start really caring about what the fossil fuel infrastructure means, what that economy means, what it means for the labor market, what it means for the global environment, what it means for their health and safety and risk. And when people have that sort of clarifying experience, you know, generally speaking, what we see is really strong opposition that is cross-partisan. It crosses all kinds of demographics, and it crosses all different parts of the region. And so I wonder if the Trump administration has had a little bit of a clarifying effect in kind of the same way for people. You know, I don't know, but that's kind of my sense, is that when confronted with something really specific, it's pretty clear that people would prefer not to keep doubling down on old school fossil fuel infrastructure.
Well, one place, what I want to focus on today are actually the three big gas projects that are, quote, in the pipeline, Tacoma, Kalama, and Jordan Cove in Southern Oregon. But I'm thinking about how two of those, I think, have nothing to do with Trump in terms of their viability and the pressures that, because they actually were really sponsored a lot by Democrats in the beginning.
Right.
But Jordan Cove would be dead if it weren't for Trump. And I just wanted to kind of review a little bit of that for listeners. And the other part of this equation with Jordan Cove is, Jordan Cove is something you used to just hear about on actually a show that's no longer on in KABU, Air Cascadia, where the host there was actually on top of Jordan Cove years and years ago. And then I started following it, and some other people started following it here. Now, everybody in Portland is talking about it, but 5 years ago, people didn't know what it was. So there's a couple, so I see it as a kind of a double-edged thing where Jordan Cove would be dead if Trump hadn't come in and replaced the Federal Energy Siting Council, or Federal Energy
Regulatory Commission,
right. If he hadn't replaced two of those commissioners with people who then immediately overrode the old FERC decision, which was going to kill the pipeline and therefore the LNG terminal. So that fight took on new life. But the other fights that are going on have actually a life of their own that's really, I think, separate from Trump politics, even though it helps. But it's actually, particularly in the case of the methanol refinery in Kalama, a lot of input from some strong Democrats, like former governor of Washington, Gary Locke. So let's first of all talk a little bit about the Trump impact on Jordan Cove, and then we can kind of look at the other ones that have different trajectory.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's right to point out, people always ask me, like, well, what do you do to stop a fossil fuel project? And the answer is, well, it depends on the project. They're all very different. They're different commodities. They're cited differently. They're backed by different people. And so it's right to not generalize about them too much, except except for the generalization that they are these huge carbon delivery mechanisms that double down on capital investments in infrastructure that we absolutely should not be making. So Jordan Cove is interesting. As folks probably know, it's a big liquefied natural gas project proposed for Coos Bay on the southern Oregon coast. What it would do is basically pipe in a large quantity of fracked gas to that site, super cool it and liquefy it, and then put it on ocean-going vessels to China. As you said, FERC has actually invalidated that project twice before. The most recent time on sort of economic grounds, that it was going to present a cost to the local community, particularly to the landowners over whom the pipeline route would pass. And there was no identifiable economic upside to it. That is, there wasn't. It's not clear that there was a market for the gas in Asia. That was under the FERC is supposed to be sort of independent from the presidency, but that decision happened under Obama. Then, as you said, Trump installed two new commissioners. I think it was two new commissioners, and they subsequently have gotten pretty aggressive about letting them push forward. So they've resubmitted a project application, and they're trying to move forward with that.
And by the way, there will be a hearing in Salem a week from tomorrow on the 15th, it's a hearing around the permit application for the build and fill, which is it has to do with getting a permit so they can dredge the harbor and do some other nasty things down there. So people are invited to attend that hearing and to make comments, and there's more information about that on, I think you can probably go to Columbia Riverkeeper website, and they have a comment form, and also 350 PDX does.
Yeah, that's good for folks to be aware of, for sure. I mean, this stuff is alive right now. It's stoppable right now too. It's really heartening to me. You're totally absolutely right. Jordan Cove was overlooked and sort of or under attended to for years and years, and many of us were sort of probably focused on coal export terminals and oil by rail terminals to the exclusion of some of those gas projects like Jordan Cove. So it's really nice to see it getting the attention it deserves, because that project is enormous and super damaging if it's actually built. It's stoppable too. So, it is definitely what we've seen in the history of this movement, this Thin Green Line movement, is that these projects can be beaten by local communities and by regional coalitions. There's every reason to think we can stop this one too. And particularly because, Oregon has elected officials and agencies that are equipped to make the right decision about this stuff. So it would be really nice to see Governor Brown, Kate Brown, get more involved in that project, as well as some of the state agencies that have permitting authority over it. I'm always cautiously optimistic at best, but I'm cautiously optimistic that Oregon can stop that project.
So I was talking with one of the organizers of the landowners whose land the pipeline would go through, and she was telling me the rumor mill that's circulating in southern Oregon about Kate Brown's political aspirations. And my thought had been, once she gets reelected, she's got nothing to lose. She can come out strongly against Jordan Cove. But I hadn't thought about what she plans to do after she's termed out as governor. So that's the thing, and I'd like to get into this conversation a little bit later when we start talking about the gas projects in Washington, because I think there's a place where Democrats, who particularly with strong union ties, they feel hamstrung in terms of really coming out against these projects, and so that's a whole other area that we need to focus on in 2019, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I have worked on any number of fossil fuel proposals of different fuel types, and I heard a lot when Trump was elected, well, isn't this going to completely change the dynamic, and now the Republicans have control, and isn't this going to be so bad? And the response to that was, well, it'll probably make things worse, but it's not like this has not been a problem that is solely confined to the Republicans. The Democrats have, and many prominent Democrats in the Northwest, have been big boosters and backers of fossil fuel export projects, or were slow to take a position on it. And so, Governor Inslee has really done some positive things on the, Vancouver, Washington oil by rail terminal and some other things. But, with respect to the big gas projects like the methanol refinery you mentioned at Kalama and some others, we've seen, Democrats who either are actively in support of the project or won't take a position or sort of don't want to get near it. So it's not the case that, I really think that a lot of these movements do not fit neatly into partisan compartments. Probably on average, I guess, the Democratic elected officials are better, but it's not. It's a mistake to think about this as a partisan issue, in my judgment. There are lots of places that are quite conservative that have done really important work stopping fossil fuel infrastructure, and it's important to honor that and recognize that, too.
Well, speaking of those places, one of them used to be very conservative, was Vancouver, Washington. And before we move into the present with a couple really big gas projects in Washington State, just wanted to take a moment. You mentioned Governor Inslee, and it was almost a year ago that we gathered across the street from City Hall in Vancouver to celebrate Inslee's denial of the permit to allow the Soros Savage's Vancouver Energy Oil by Rail Terminal, the largest in North America, to be built in Vancouver. And I remember the jubilation that day and everybody shouting out, "Thank you, Governor Inslee." And I think the question for 2019 is, how do we get Governor Inslee to consider, as he proposes his great, bold, clean, green energy vision for the state of Washington, where does methanol and LNG fit into that equation?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the right question because as folks may know, Inslee is almost certainly going to run for president. What his actual chances are of being elected, I have no idea, but I think he will at least be occupying a platform or a role within the Democratic primary that surfaces some of these issues around clean energy and around climate change, which has been his signature issue for his entire political career. So I think that'll be really interesting to watch. But, one of the things I think we'd all like to see is for him to use that that platform to say clearly that we need to move to a 100% clean energy future. And that future means no coal, no oil, no gas, no fracked gas. And we can't just mean that for our own electricity portfolio or our own portfolio. We can't become clean ourselves up and then still export huge amounts of polluting fossil fuels to Asia. And so I think getting folks like Governor Inslee to articulate that vision clearly, because he's a great messenger for it, is going to be super important. How we do that, I think, is twofold. I think that there's a sort of a substantive, rigorous technical research dimension to it that demonstrates that it's possible for our economy to do this and to do so in a way that allows us to have a prosperous economy. And the second component of it is organizing. I like to say that if you are really good at making a parade, then generally politicians will try to run to the front of the parade, which is where you want them. So we had, a lot of folks around the region did a great job of turning that oil by rail terminal into a parade, where it was clear that the entire community in the region did not want that project built. And so it makes it really easy for a politician to step into a leadership role and deny it. That's what we want to do, and we need to do that with Jordan Cove, the Coloma Methanol Refinery, Tacoma LNG, and to make it clear that these are political wins when elected officials stand up and say what we want them to say. So I really think there's a lot to be said for we got to do the work ourselves. We got to create the movement, build the infrastructure, that is the grassroots infrastructure, and make it clear that this is a win for the elected officials.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's the program's director for Sightline Institute, about the continuing fight to stop fossil fuel infrastructure from gaining a foothold in the Pacific Northwest. And this is a conversation, Eric, you and I have been having for, I don't know, a long time. I remember actually heading up to interview you about the heavy haul corridor that was trying to be put through actually Oregon for a while, Idaho, Montana, get this heavy equipment up to the tar sands in Alberta. And I think it was 2013. And on my way up, I saw my first oil train following I-5. And then I got up to talk to you, and you told me about the Vancouver Energy Terminal in Vancouver. And I realized this problem wasn't as far removed as I was thinking. It's not a problem. It's, in Alberta and turning industrializing the scenic highways between the coast and Alberta for fossil fuel infrastructure. But I realized, no, this is across the river. This is pretty serious. And it seems like since then, there's just been this continuing drumbeat. have successfully stopped almost every one of the projects that we probably were talking about back in 2013. But the two that really are that have the most life in them right now are the Tacoma LNG and the Calama methanol projects. And I had the opportunity in October to go to a really rowdy, rousing hearing in Tacoma, where the LNG facility was having a hearing about a supplemental environmental impact statement that was being required for its clean air permit, which it hadn't received yet. And the attendance was probably 85% against the LNG facility and 15% for. And what was really interesting was that we could tell who was speaking. I mean, what somebody was going to speak for by their shoes. And if they started out by saying, "I'm an environmentalist," if they were wearing fancy shoes and they were an environmentalist, they were in support of LNG, and they were either working for Puget Sound Energy, who's running the project, or they were for the Port of Tacoma, or they were the Washington Business Alliance, or they were some of the union upper echelon. In Longview, just a couple weeks ago, there was a hearing for another supplemental environmental impact statement for the methanol refinery. This is for the shoreline permit. And there, a lot of the proponents for the terminal were not dressed up in fancy suits and shoes. They were wearing their flannel shirts and their jeans and their coveralls. And they were basically union people who were speaking up. And there was a certain moment I had where I was realizing this is a real class divide here. In Tacoma, the class divide seemed to be the upper elites were in support of of LNG, the middle class and lower income people were against it. In Longview, it seemed like the strongest supporters, besides the invisible elite who we didn't really see except for a couple county commissioners, that these people are real working people who are supporting it. So my thought is, how do we organize to reach out to workers who feel like these fossil fuel projects are their only hope?
Yeah, great question. And again, I think really important framing to recognize that the dynamics of these, both the physical infrastructure dynamics and the political dynamics, are not the same from project to project. They're all really different. So I think that's a useful thing to remember. You know, the question of how do you organize labor and make the case, an economic case, in a community where there's high unemployment, where wages are relatively low, and where economic development is hard? And that describes Longview and Calama and some other places around the region. So I think number one is we need to recognize that the modern economy has, you know, it has superheated Portland and Seattle and Bellevue and a few places like that that have, you know, in some ways done really well, at least on paper, although I think the truth of the matter is a little more complex. Homelessness is an indicator of how complex that economic growth is. But leaving that aside for a second, there are other places that aren't in the kind of, you know, central Puget Sound region or in the Portland area that have not done very well, honestly. And Coos Bay is an example of that as well. So I think we need to be really clear-eyed about the fact that that there are not easy economic development solutions for those communities that allow people to find, you know, good long-term, well-paying work, and we need to take on that challenge in a really serious way, and not sort of wave it away with windmills in the future or something like that. Our side doesn't really tend to wave it away too much, but I do think we have to be really honest about what the challenges are, because you know, my strong sense from having talked to a lot of those labor folks over the years is that they'd rather be doing something else, right? They'd rather not have a new petrochemical refinery be their best choice, particularly not one exporting raw materials to China for manufacturing there. But the modern economy hasn't provided other alternatives for them, and so they are. My view is that a lot of those communities are looking at trying to make the best of two bad choices. That is, build a petrochemical refinery on the one hand, and on the other hand is continued high unemployment. So I think it's honestly it's a super tricky dynamic, and I do think we have to kind of go upstream on some level and demonstrate that that we can figure out a way to make capital investment in the labor economy in those places, and I think we need to speak with people in a really authentic way about that. You know, I always am reminded of the great success at Vancouver, Washington, where a lot of the unions came out against the oil by rail project, recognizing that the potential for an oil spill on the river there would have done a lot of harm. And maybe it's the case that we can begin to have conversations with people and begin to make the argument that, you know, citing something like a petrochemical refinery, it actually does long-term harm to the economy. It's worse than doing nothing. So that's one starter, but I'd be interested to hear kind of your view on that based on what you saw.
Well, actually, I was just thinking about Vancouver as such an interesting model for change, because I've just been watching with my mouth open for the last 6-7 years about how Vancouver is really transforming itself from what people in Portland used to refer to as Vantucky. Which not very kind of Portlanders, actually. But I have a really good friend who moved to Vancouver, actually, a number of years ago, as Vancouver was just beginning its renaissance. So I did see some of this through his eyes, too. But I spent a lot of time in Vancouver in the last few years and discovered an incredible progressive movement. And the progressive movement was maybe a lot broader in terms of political persuasions than it would be in Portland, because there were Republicans, and you commented on this in my last documentary, about one of the Republican leaders who wanted to do this whole development along the waterfront, who became a real ardent opponent of the oil by train terminal. And he's there locked in arms with people like Don and Ilona Steike, who are, you know, longtime Democratic progressive activists, Sierra Club people. But one of the things that I was thinking that was different about the Vancouver port and the Calama port is one of the concerns that the longshoremen, who were the lead organization that first took on fighting the oil terminal, and they pointed out how many wind turbines they're exporting through the port. So there was already a foothold in the port of Vancouver for doing renewable stuff. Calama doesn't have that. And I wonder what it would take to get Calama to be able to see that maybe we can be exporting or manufacturing and exporting or maybe importing items that are, you know, really renewable and really help our economy.
Yeah, and I think that's the right question to ask. I wish I had a crisp answer to it. I wish I had something we could say that would sort of prove the point. But I think that's the right thing for us to do for the, by us, I don't mean just sort of grassroots activists, but I mean the region as a whole is to really build out the clean energy economy in a way that manifests itself in hard physical infrastructure and jobs and all the rest of it. And we see that in some places. I mean, it's happening in some places for sure. And like you said, at the Port of Vancouver, also in lots of other places. But you know, if we can figure out how to make, you know, the next suite of investments in whether it's import-export infrastructure or whether it's power-producing infrastructure or something else in communities like Calama, I think that goes a long, long way to sort of re-engineering and rebuilding the economy and actually the politics in a way that's more favorable to a climate-stable future. But those things are tricky. I mean, it's not easy to figure out how to do that. I mean, and I will say, I will give Governor Inslee some real credit, because he has, I mean, his entire political career, when he was in Congress and as governor, he has talked a lot about that you need both. You need both a stern approach to climate pollution, and then you also need to build. You need to treat it as a sort of an economic exercise. You got to actually build the stuff and make it clear to people that climate responsibility is the pathway to economic prosperity. And so I really think that sort of double helix strand is the right strategy for thinking about this stuff.
Well, also thinking about the major class divide, and to me, there's nothing more visual to use as an example as the, what are they called? The ports of Seattle and Tacoma, they have an alliance now. I forget what the name of the alliance is, but
the Seaport Alliance.
Seaport Alliance, right. So Seattle gets the cruise ships. Tacoma gets the oil refinery, the LNG tank, a number of other very polluting industries. And it seems to be that's just fine. I mean, a lot of people in Tacoma don't feel it's fine, but even Tacoma is portrayed by some people in the Seaport Alliance as, well, Tacoma doesn't really care about health like people in Seattle do. So it seems like there's an awful lot of education that has to be done, starting with the grassroots and going up through the upper echelons of the political structure.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's also important to realize that a lot of these communities that are being proposed for this fossil fuel infrastructure, almost without exception, they are sort of being targeted because they are believed to not have the level of political sophistication or power that a place like Seattle has you wouldn't cite any of that stuff in Seattle because it would be slapped down so hard that anybody behind it would be run out of town. And they've tried to do it over and over again in Tacoma on exactly those optics. And so when you go to those hearings in Tacoma, you will hear what I think is an absolutely correct portrayal, which is you wouldn't do this in Seattle. You're trying to do it here because you don't think we have enough power. And as a consequence, it's in a way, it's almost like a bullying tactic by the industry, that they're going to places that are relatively powerless. Now, Tacoma, it turns out, is not powerless at all. That community has absolutely revolted in the face of several fossil fuel infrastructure proposals, and actually, it's changed the nature of politics in that city already, and will continue to change it more. But I think it's really interesting when local communities start to realize that this isn't an opportunity that's being presented to them. They're being attacked. And you see that in a big, big way in a community like Tacoma, which I think is kind of exciting.
Actually, I was just going over an interview that I conducted with one of the activists in Tacoma. I recorded it last spring, and she was talking about the methanol fight. And she went to a meeting. This is where she met you. It was at the University of Washington Tacoma campus, and you were talking about the Thin Green Line. And then she realized it wasn't just their problem. This was a whole affront on the entire region. And it made more sense to her, and it also made her feel more empowered. So let's talk about that. I mean, you changed some hearts and minds there in Tacoma that day.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that. I had one local activist said that there was already gasoline there, and then I lit the match and threw it down. So I'm really pleased with the way that's happened. But for folks who may not know, I mean, Tacoma, I think everybody recognizes, has long been a pretty working class, pretty industrial city. Has a long legacy of pollution and of pollution cleanups that are almost near completion now. But in the last couple of years, it's been targeted for an oil refinery expansion, this big liquefied natural gas project we've kind of mentioned a couple times, and this huge petrochemical refinery, a methanol project, actually twice as big as the one in Calama.
My goodness. West Rock, which used to be Simpson Lumber, which was one of the sources of the aroma of Tacoma many years ago, and they are filing for a major expansion, which is going to allow them to put, I don't know, double the amount of pollutants that they put in the air. So that's something that actually, I don't think that struggle is being as well publicized outside of the Tacoma area, but something else to think about.
Good point. Thanks, sir. I'm glad you mentioned that. And it's interesting, too, because the kind of the political class in Tacoma, even 5 years ago, was either quiet on it or actively in favor of these projects. And it became really clear in the context of that dispute over the methanol project that the people of Tacoma were absolutely in a very different place than the political class, and they showed up in force. And I mean, I've seen a bunch of pretty heated political disputes, but that's got to be right up in the top three, if not the number one most heated dispute I've ever seen. And folks showed up, and they kept showing up, and they kept saying, our response to this proposal is no. It's a hard no. There's nothing you can do to change it. The answer is no. And it came from a place of feeling, and correctly, that they were being targeted, that they were finally cleaning up decades of pollution that had a real profound impact on people's health in that community, and they were looking down the barrel of another project. So you fast forward to now, and the city council in Tacoma has unanimously banned new fossil fuel developments in the industrial port area. Now, existing facilities can still apply for expansion. We haven't solved that yet, but they just renewed the moratorium. They almost actually got to a vote where they were going to ban expansions at existing facilities too, which would be cool to see. But Tacoma now it's not quite as progressive as the anti-fossil fuel land use in Portland, but it's kind of just one step behind there. And so to me, it's really interesting that in just the space of a few years, the political realities in that community have militated from pro-fossil fuel development to absolutely not, no, we don't want any expansion of it at all.
You're a little bit more optimistic about it than my friends in Tacoma are. I was out there during those hearings for the city hall, city council hearings, and people were really, really disappointed that they couldn't get anything. Basically, they just extended the moratorium as it was, and they didn't make it any stronger. So.
Yeah, but true, and I recognize their disappointments. I hear from them from time to time, which I appreciate. But I think they're going to get what they want. I think, what I want, what we all want, which is I think that in subsequent rounds, existing facilities will be prevented from expansion. I mean, the politics on city council have already changed favorably on that. I think they'll change more. That's an argument we can win. In a place like Tacoma, it's not happening as fast as I would like, or certainly as they would like. But I am optimistic in Tacoma for sure, and I know that view is not universally shared.
I'll let them know. Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and today we're talking with Eric DePlace, Programs Director for Sightline Institute, about the continuing fight to stop fossil fuel infrastructure from gaining a foothold in the Pacific Northwest. Well, I wanted to conclude today by talking about greenwashing, which is one of the things I have just been shaking my head over for the last few weeks after going particularly to the hearing for the methanol refinery in Kalama that was held in Longview on December 13th. And I feel like I was listening to greenwashing like I have never heard before. So first of all, I was also asked today by a possible funder that she never heard of the term greenwashing. So I was wondering if you can define greenwashing, and then we can talk about how it's gone up to a new level in this fossil fuel, particularly in the frack gas fight.
Yeah, well, probably the shortest definition of greenwashing would be using environmental rhetoric in order to pursue an end that's harmful to the environment. So I'll tell you a quick story that I think may be relevant to what's happening in Kalama. So this is a few years ago. This is 7 or 8 years ago. I was asked to go down to Louisiana to help some activists there fight off a couple of coal terminals, and was just doing some strategy sessions with them. And we ended up in a bar one afternoon in New Orleans, and at the time, the oil industry in Washington was fighting a tax loophole closure, and I was showing them the oil industry's webpage. And the webpage was, it was like pictures of Mount Rainier and people hiking and I think somebody fishing. And they were trying to dress up this oil industry tax benefit as something beneficial for the environment. And the activists in Louisiana just burst out laughing, and they were like, look, the oil industry here they put out a picture of an oil spill with a giant FU across the top of it and just ran it through anyway. The point of that story is that, like, in lots of places where the fossil fuel industry has control of the political mechanisms, they don't care. They don't need to do that level of greenwashing. But in the Northwest, we're winning, and we're winning consistently all the time on big projects. And we're winning very often on making an environmental argument that this is not right for the global climate or for our local environment or what have you. And so they've had to adapt. And, they've adapted now well past the point of putting Mount Rainier on our website or on their website. And now they've developed these really sophisticated, poll-tested, focus group-tested marketing strategies to try to persuade people that, they've already lost the argument in a way. Like, they've already had to concede that the region wants environmental progress, that the region wants climate progress. So now they have to convince people that, okay, well, this giant fossil fuel project actually does that. It actually is good for the climate. It is good for the environment. So they're really, in a way, they're getting, you're right, I mean, super sophisticated, but they're already fighting kind of on the wrong turf for them.
Well, actually, I mean, I'm thinking about this guy, Ken Caputo, who is the general counsel and has another role for Northwest Innovation Works, the company, the Chinese-backed company that wants to build the methanol refinery in Kalama, and also is very interested in building one across the river at Port Westward in Oregon. And he was on Oregon Public Broadcasting debating, or more or less, conversation with Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey from Columbia Riverkeeper. And he touts his Democratic Party credentials. He's worked with the tribes in eastern Washington. He worked for Governor Lowry many years ago. And he drives an electric car. He told me that, too. And he's very proud of that. And so he sees himself as a progressive left, liberal Democrat who really believes that bringing methanol to China so they can use that to make plastics instead of using coal is an advance for the environment. And he's very smooth in the way he does it. And I talked to people who listened to that OPB interview, and they really thought he was pretty impressive. I mean, these are people who were there testifying against the methanol refinery in Longview a few weeks ago. So they, NWIW had a really hard time making a case in Tacoma 4 years ago, or 3 years ago. But they are they've really gotten a lot sharper, and having this guy be their mouthpiece really is, I think, a coup for them. And I wonder, how do we get beyond that?
Yeah. Well, I think it's super interesting that they have gotten so much more sophisticated, for sure. And I mean, out of necessity, because they think they know they're going to lose if they don't get a lot more sophisticated, as was demonstrated in Tacoma when that project went down. I think the antidote is to stay relatively focused on the major components of this thing and not get kind of bogged down into these weird and ultimately incorrect technical arguments about the economics of commodity markets overseas for the next 30 or 40 years, which are unknown. And anyway, but it's like the fundamentals of this project, right? It's gonna move huge quantities of fracked gas, staggering quantities of fracked gas down a pipeline corridor, probably from Canada, although some may come from other places too. Then it will, they don't like the word refine, but it will distill, refine, process that natural gas into a liquid petrochemical and send it to China to make plastics. And so fracking, pipeline, refining, petrochemicals, plastics, like that is what the project is about. And there are all kinds of impacts, all kinds of risks with that. And I think we really need to stick to the fundamentals on this stuff and remind people that this project is designed to make plastics manufacturing cheaper. And we're going to do that by exporting North American fossil fuels to China. It's on that level, the intuitive level, it is correct. It doesn't make any sense. It's not good for us. It's not good for the climate. We don't need more cheap plastics. You know, blah, 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 blah. And I think it's important in this case not to get drawn down. They're trying to produce these really sort of, you know, abstract, technical, theoretical arguments that it somehow will shift the methanol market in China in a way that's positive. And that's not true. But I think we should in some ways refrain from going down that rabbit hole with them.
But actually, I've been studying the life cycle analysis for the methanol refinery. Which, by the way, the reason why they don't like calling it a refinery, but one of the union people said in Longview, refineries are dirty and polluting, and this will not be dirty and polluting, therefore it's not a refinery, which I thought was a very interesting definition of refinery. But that's beside the point. Anyway, the life cycle analysis, I mean, from what I'm understanding, the science is really flawed that they use. And so that's one of the things I'm digging out right now and talking to people who have analyzed it and looking at the whole issue about methane leaks and fugitive methane emissions. And I do think that that's important stuff, even though it's a little bit wonky for people. I wonder if you think that there's ways that we can use that data. Is a compelling way to debunk the data that they use in the SEIS, which in fact is a document that could make or break whether they get that permit for the shoreline permit. So I guess I would think that we do need to talk about that to some degree and not just stick to the basics that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of a two-pronged approach, like from an organizing perspective and from the perspective of getting people to understand the risks and threats on kind of an intuitive level. I think we want to stick with a relatively sort of clean fundamental messages. We do have to, on some level, engage with these research papers they've been waving around that purport to claim that there's an environmental benefit to it. And we need to go after that stuff and pull it apart because, as you say, the assumptions in there are wrong. They've got some really flawed methodology. There are some folks on our side who are quite capable of taking that stuff apart and dismantling it. And we need to do that, too, because we cannot allow them to sort of with government agencies or in legal proceedings or anything else, kind of occupy, some technical high ground with this stuff. We need to go after those assumptions and demonstrate that the stuff that they're assuming when they make those arguments is just it's not just wrong. Some of it's obviously wrong.
Well, one of the things that I found the most disconcerting was listening and hearing to one union member after another and also some of the county commissioners and other elected officials talking about how Columbia Riverkeeper has been proven wrong about the benefits or the harm that this methanol refinery would pose. And the only reason, and they're standing in the way of progress because this methanol refinery not only will provide jobs for people in Kalama, but will clean the air in China and people who oppose the methanol refinery don't want the Chinese to breathe clean air, and that's racist. And then furthermore, the final blow was saying that Columbia Riverkeeper doesn't really care about the environment or climate change. What they care about is staying in business, and that's why they're opposing the refinery. So in a nutshell, how would you counter that?
Well, those arguments are galling, and I'm my mouth is hanging open right now. I'm sorry. I can say confidently that Columbia Riverkeeper would rather be doing almost anything than fighting a methanol project in Kalama. But I think it's the fossil fuel industry, the industry that wants to frack all that gas, ship it, and make plastics. When have they ever had people's best interests at heart? This is a project that is owned by the Chinese government, that is designed to increase Chinese plastics manufacturing. That is not an industry, on anyone's understanding, that has workers' best interests at heart, or the global environment at heart, or our oceans at heart, or any of that stuff. I don't want to kind of engage on the silliness of those arguments and the defensiveness of those arguments, but simply to point out, like, what is the project? What does it mean, and who's behind it? I think on that level, it's obvious that the right answer is we don't build this. This isn't what we want on the north in the Northwest. We don't want this stuff on the Columbia River. It's a raw deal for us. And we need to say no and figure out something better.
And on that note, we have to end. But it's really good to talk with you, Eric, and we'll talk again really soon.
Well, thanks, Barbara. Appreciate being on the show again.
I actually kind of think of you as my co-host, so we'll have you on in a few weeks.
Okay. Oh, good.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking today with Eric DePlace, Programs Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Ali Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate about the latest on Jordan Cove, the LNG terminal that's being proposed for Coos Bay. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Ricky Lee Jones. Thanks for listening.
He's an ugly man. He always was an ugly man. He grew up to be